Welcome to Great Minds, as we now are in season 5, which is hard to believe. And we're thrilled to talk today to Emma Lacey. Emma is the Senior Vice President of Zephyr. She's in my, I don't know if I can say favorite city, that sounds like poor form, but certainly a very close second to my home of New York, which is, of course, the great city of London. Zephyr is a really interesting company. We know them a long time. They are really leading that next generation of brand suitability, working on the front lines of enabling effectiveness, but while also ensuring that brand values, social responsibility, privacy, we're going to talk about the elections and misinformation, but you are really playing in the middle of one of the most interesting spaces within the walled garden ecosystem. And thrilled to have a chance to talk to you today, Emma. So welcome.
Thank you. I feel pretty humbled to be here, actually. Series 5, so many people have come before me. So I really do appreciate you inviting me to be on.
Oh, no, it's great, great, great to have you.
And I must say, you're in my favorite city. So if I'm in yours, we can, you know, New York is fantastic. And I've worked there a little bit and it's a great place to be.
Yeah, I think Londoners love New York and New Yorkers love London.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So before we got on, Emma, we were talking a little bit about business culture and the current state. It's a Monday. I happen to be in the office today. You happen to be working from home, but I think we both sort of have a similar view about where we are on business culture now and maybe some differences between the UK and the USA. But I'd love to get your thoughts on where we are in business culture, where we work, what is gained and what is lost.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, as we were just saying, in London, there has been a return to people being together, being in the office, collaborating more. And it's been over the last 12 months that we've really seen that comeback. But it's certainly not where it was when, you know, I started out in my media career 20 years ago, I think. And, you know, some of that's good. There's been some elements of that that I believe we can look back on and be like, that's a bit old fashioned. I think there are better ways of working, you know, and we did survive. We did keep our heads above water when we were working from home during COVID. But that being said, there is nothing that compares to talking amongst your teams in person. And honestly, from a new business perspective, sitting in a room with a client and being able to look them in the eyes and have an honest, candid conversation. I just don't think you can get that across the screen. So it's been refreshing that things are busy, that, you know, I went into an agency last week and there was nowhere to sit. And that's the first time I've had that problem for a very long time. So it's good the culture is back, but I do think it's been sort of surprising how long it's taken to get there.
Yeah, I continue to marvel at how quickly this behavioral change happened. You know, for 200 some odd years, you know, give or take, you go to work Monday to Friday. And certain industries, I think, had summer Fridays, which I always thought was a little soft, but okay. But the way it is now is just, we've gone so far the other way. And I think there are certain industries, certain sectors, certain companies that have leverage. Certainly the financial sector, our office down here is now on Broadway and Wall, right around the corner from the New York Stock Exchange. And I think a lot of those companies have said, you're coming to work 5 days a week and that's it, you know, where you can go work somewhere else. But a lot of industries and specific businesses, ours being one of them, I think this is fair to say, simply don't have that leverage.
Yeah. And look, I do feel that it depends to a degree on what your role is as to how you can justify whether you're in the office or, you know, whether you can be as effective at home. I really do think that anyone in a commercial role needs to be together and that, you know, you're face-to-face with clients all the time. So, you know, it's just natural that you're going to be coming and going. And I think that's where we've seen the biggest return. But I think ultimately it's any new innovation requires people to be in a room brainstorming and that organic conversation and, you know, the generation of ideas when you're together. As I said, I just don't think it's been as easy to make those kind of decisions and progressions in business whilst we've all been, you know, out of the office. But on the other hand, so when we went into lockdown, I had a newborn baby. And so returning to work was quite different the second time from my first experience where, you know, it was racing into the office for 7 o'clock in the morning so I could leave a little bit early. And I think some flexibility has been hugely appreciated by me. But I do think it's, again, got to be a much more measured approach. And we just need to figure out what is right for the business, first and foremost, and growth in that business. But equally, you know, what works for people and, you know, how do we hold them accountable in their roles? And if they are performing, you know, then I think sometimes there is a need for some flexibility. And I think that is, you know, we had a lot about that last week with International Women's Day. But I think there is a balance. And I think we're getting to a better place for that. But I think being wholly resistant to being back in the office is something that people need to sort of rethink. Because as you say, I mean, we literally spent decades and decades all being together. And that was how we had strong economies, we had strong new businesses, and there were businesses of lots of different size. And I don't think you get that diversification right now, certainly in media. Maybe some of that is because we haven't been, you know, following our original paths of working together.
Yeah, I think the counter, I won't contradict myself or flip-flop, but the counter, what a lot of people say, and younger people in particular, is they're busy all day. They're on Zoom calls. And I think our business, listen, we had a really good year last year. I mean, you know, our team works really hard. I think what we do is a reflective mirror of the business culture of the advertising and media and marketing, technology, content creation, you know, all those sectors. So I don't think it's you can't be effective, because I certainly think you can, you know, in this, let's call it remote first often environment. But I do think that the looking someone in the eye, what we're doing right now, we're give or take 3,000 miles apart, separated by an ocean, we're able to do this very effectively. We're able to look at each other.
But if I put up some slides and started presenting, it would be a very different experience very quickly. And that's where, you know, you lose the kind of interest and the engagement of the person you're talking to. It's no longer a conversation. It's like, oh, there's some slides. Let me just check my emails. Is there anything new come in? Or multitasking. And I feel that has been one of the biggest challenges to try and overcome whilst we were all working from home. And, you know, initially it was, you know, is your camera on or off? And obviously that quickly got rectified and everyone had their cameras on. But ultimately, multitasking during video calls is never going to be resolved. So that's why, you know, I like to kind of be in a room with someone and just, you know, if it's a coffee, a glass of wine, or, you know, just something a bit more formal, I do think you cannot put a price on the value of just being together and having that one-on-one.
I couldn't agree more. And the building and strengthening of relationships, I do think that as whether you're a human or whether you are a creature in the jungle, I do think that, you know, you look at the behavior. We went last year after Advertising Week Africa, very dear friend of ours, Khalid Sheriff, the CEO of eMedia, which is our biggest media partner over there, their huge television network in South Africa, took my wife and daughter and I on safari. And you see how it really works. And it's not the lions, the giraffes, they're all with each other. And in the most basic way, if you're breathing, you want to be with other creatures of, you know, similar, or in the case of the jungle, you may be looking for something to eat, but you want to be with others, you know, I guess is the net.
Yeah, no, community driven. And I think it's inherent in who we are as humans. And I do think we bring out the best in one another, especially from a business perspective when we're together. And I think it is, we did all survive and we did, some businesses really flourished. But I do think if you were coming in with something new, or like we are at Zephyr, you know, more of a challenger to some of the big legacy technologies, it was, you know, not as straightforward as I think it might have been entering into new markets and trying to have that growth opportunity that we would have had if we'd all been kind of in work as we had been pre-COVID. But it's great to see it returning. And I do think this year feels very exciting. It feels like people are together. Everyone is kind of much more on the same page. And it's the agencies are back, the clients are back, and, you know, all the ad tech partners are back. And so it's good. I think we're in a much more positive place than we were.
And there are a lot of columns now in the real estate sections of the paper about office occupancy going back up. And I think that's very encouraging. All right, this is a pet peeve topic, so let's move on. Emma, you know, usually we'll walk through someone's career sort of semi-chronologically, and you've had some great, great stints at some great companies, at Sky, at HarperCollins, at AOL. AOL is one that jumps out at me because we had so many dear friends there. And I think similar to Yahoo, it became a great farm system of talent. Folks who are now, you know, at, you know, really cutting edge companies like Zephyr, but who spent, you know, some time at AOL. And a dear friend of ours, Linda Clarizio, is now on the board of our parent company, Emerald. She was, as I introduced her, she was one of the many presidents that we dealt with over the years at AOL. And there were probably 7 or 8 since we started Advertising Week 20 some odd years ago. I'd love to reflect on your time there. You had a pretty big gig working for AOL. It was an interesting time for the company. And take the clock back to those AOL days.
At that time, you would be hard pushed not to bump into someone who had at some point worked at AOL with the ad.com and all the different businesses that they kind of acquired and merged over that period of time. I mean, I look at it so fondly. It was absolutely the formative stage of my career. Tim Armstrong was at the helm, and I think he did an incredible job of turning around the business. It was being, it had a few different identities, Platform A, like, you know, there had been, it got a bit confused. I joined at that time when Tim was very much, this is what we're going to do. We're going to invest in really great content. We're going to build on the audiences that we have. And as you referenced Yahoo, those sort of legacy portals, they were challenged and they had incredible email customers and people who logged in. And from an AOL perspective, the dial-up business was still there and actually surprisingly strong, but it needed a new identity. And I think he made some very smart moves. We bought businesses like the Huffington Post to really bring it into being more, again, more of a challenger business than it had been seen as. It was seen as the dinosaur. And it's like, actually, don't write us off just yet. At that time, I really enjoyed working with the journalists and writers who were creating amazing editorial. It was the original native sort of solutions in advertising. We won some business that you probably wouldn't have thought we deserved. We really did. We had great technology, which was definitely ad.com was an incredible foundation for programmatic. It was, as you referenced, it was really good people. You know, some of my favorite people and closest friends in the industry I worked with at that time. And as I say, they were happy days. They were when digital was definitely sort of the rocket ship, but starting to change. You know, as I said, it's like you had these strong content environments that were being pushed. Social was just on the rise and you were starting to see how you could leverage social to build new incremental audiences, but also programmatic came in. And I think that was a shock to sort of figure out, well, where is everyone going to sit? What people do we need? What skills do they need to have? But ultimately, you know, how can you take your first party data and make better campaigns and, you know, manage the yield and of the publisher and the performance of the campaign at the same time? And yeah, it was just really exciting. Honestly, I really loved it. And it was probably the most fun I've had. And going back to our previous conversation, being together, that was exactly it. You know, I had a very large team and they were all doing different things and looking after different clients. And we would come together and have an enormous amount of fun whilst working really hard.
So let's frame the next question in context with where we've come, right? We're about, give or take, 15 years nearly from when you began at AOL. And as you said, those were the emerging days of programmatic. It was also the emerging days of video as a dominant medium on the web.
And mobile, actually, as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely true. And it was really that time when the pipe was just starting to get big enough where you could get and receive video to your mobile without watching something spin for some indeterminable number of minutes waiting for it to come up. Talk about the evolution there. You worked with a lot of agencies, with Group M, with Aegis, with others. Talk about the evolution of the agency ecosystem, what they saw then, what they didn't do that ultimately may have been a mistake. But give us some reflections on the journey of where we were then and where we are now. You've managed and dealt with just about all the big agency groups over your career.
So I think the thing that changed, I think homepage takeovers, you know, it was sponsoring content and putting some pretty ads around the pages. And that was where digital had kind of reached this original crescendo of like, this is really good. Or you have the ad networks, you know, who were just kind of banging out ads and delivering strong CPAs. Now, AOL was lucky because we played on both sides of that. But I think what happened was almost like a convergence. And so the agencies started to realize we need to ask more questions. We need to ask, what device are they on? That was a totally new conversation, which is why I had mentioned mobile, because it went from being 90% of our impressions were being served on a desktop to 50-50. So now it's not even a question. You don't really ask about those sort of devices. So it's sort of incredible how that started to really proliferate where the media was being bought and how. And then you had to think about, well, what's the mindset of that consumer? Because, you know, a big homepage takeover doesn't have the impact that it had on a mobile device as it did when you're on a desktop. And where people were finding content, we used to go to maybe 20 different websites a day as consumers, where you had your loyalty. It could be The Guardian, it could be The Telegraph, it could have been The Huffington Post. But actually, as I think we're inherently lazy as kind of humans. And so when you can go somewhere like Twitter or to Facebook and start to find content there that is, you know, that's clever algorithms that are saying, I know you're interested in this, you'll probably be interested in that as well. And that's where we were starting to surface our content to find, as I said earlier, those new audiences. And so agencies had to start to think, well, how am I buying? Where am I buying? And actually, how should I be measuring success? We went through a stage of, actually, we rolled out something called Devil Ads, and we got rid of all the ads on the page around really strong content, except one big kind of super leaderboard and actually one super skyscraper. And it was suddenly they were interactive and it was all about engagement. And before it just been clicks and did they land on the page? And it was like, people don't necessarily want to have their experience of content disrupted by a brand, or if they do, it's got to add value to the page, and we don't really want to go somewhere else to find out more. We want to find out whilst we're consuming the content that we actually were interested in the first place. And so I do think the psychology of consumers, and I think as we all became more mature in our browsing habits anyway, I think it was just that shift where brands had to really think about what they'd been doing for years on TV and building up those loyalty with potential customers or existing customers to keep them choosing their detergent and not the supermarket's own. There was something like, well, actually, we're going to have to do something similar online. And so I think that's where, at that point in time, that felt really kind of relevant and certainly where we were challenging as a business. And I think we talked very reformed and very kind of ahead of the curve in terms of trying to predict what was going to happen. This kind of heat maps, where are people browsing? And actually, they became a bit of a cliche, but they were important. It's like, what are people doing? And so for the Huffington Post, they had really long pages. And that was an Arianna Huffington's vision. And we stuck with it when we launched the different markets for that site. But we were told no one will be scrolling down. And we were like, they are. Look, they're going down. We can show you that they are. And that's why the ad needs to be with them. You know. And so it's just subtle little changes that were being made. And then you had to look at, well, from the programmatic side, what can you automate? What can actually be bought that is a standard, you know, which generally were MPUs, leaderboards, Skys. You know, what can you buy, but still think about who is that audience? Can you get the premium publishers and aggregate them together? Can you drop a pixel and work to figure out where that consumer went after they're exposed to the ad? I think there was a lot of concern. And, you know, I think some of the big publishers were definitely reticent to venture into programmatic and kind of give away the crown jewels. But those that didn't, I think, struggled to then monetize, because agencies are busy. They need to find, it's much easier to run one campaign across lots and lots of publishers than just go to each one individually. We had a parenting site and we used to do really well. And then suddenly it's like, well, we just want to buy it with all the other parenting sites. The challenge, I think, for AOL at the time was certainly, how do you balance the cost of creating that really great content and, you know, paying fantastic journalists to contribute to the different platforms and content environments that we had, whilst monetization was being, I guess, the value, you know, the CPMs were lowering because they were being aggregated rather than being bought directly. So, you know, as always in digital, you have to go through this period of change and people have to figure it out. Yeah, it was definitely a very interesting period of time. And to your point, an addressable video really started to be challenging. And everyone started to go, right, we can't just put images up there. We've got to start to create great video content. And that really is expensive. some of the ways that brands were leaning into that. Some did it incredibly well, and some they were just kind of maybe a little bit lazy and taking just TVC assets and going, right, works very well on ITV or, you know, CNN, but actually now let's just kind of stick that on a web page and hope that it has the same impact. And that's where it doesn't on a mobile device. So I think there's been a lot of education and change in the creative side as well.
Yeah, I think certainly the dominance of the mobile phone is really, really something that I think some have navigated much better than others. Let's talk about your tenure at HarperCollins, really leading their digital efforts at a time when it was in its infancy in many ways. This was prior to your tenure at AOL. Book publishing is one of the industries, arguably goes in the same bucket as the magazine business and the newspaper business in general terms, that have not navigated the digital evolution and revolution as well as other genres of media have. Talk about that tenure and what it meant to be in digital at HarperCollins in 2009.
Gosh, it's coming back, isn't it? So I had previously worked for probably my first mentor in digital, called Charlie Redmayne. And he'd had a startup business and it was bought by Sky. And he then, after his tenure at Sky, went to HarperCollins. And the reason why they chose him to come and run their digital business is because his sort of approach to taking and creating content online and, you know, trying to monetize it and find new ways of making it accessible to new eyeballs and new users was something that they felt they were really challenged as a business. If you think about book publishing, I mean, firstly, it's a very different commercial model. You'll pay a lot of upfront for the author before they've even written anything to print, to publish, to distribute. Especially in kind of that period where it really was around hardback books and trying to make sure that people were buying them off the shelves in bookstores. So they brought Charlie in to sort of figure out, well, how do you start to take very traditional classic books and do something with it? He persuaded me to join him. We'd been a really good team. And it was really exciting because it was at a period of time where iPads were rolling out and suddenly ebooks became a thing. And also we knew that platforms like MySpace and social media were becoming a thing. And so they created websites to build up for book lovers or to actually new authors and try and help them distribute and get their books discovered. And so it was a really different business for sure, but it was bringing in that sort of digital experience and commercial skills of kind of monetizing good content online to that kind of environment. Now, it was definitely challenging because you're looking at very traditional businesses who very protective of, you know, if we talk about premium content online, it's nothing compared to premium book content. It should be respected. And I think it was exciting to be part of that period of time where Amazon was suddenly like, we're going to sell books really cheaply online. And actually, we came together with other publishing houses to say, we're not going to allow that for ebooks. You've already done it for the traditional books, but we're not allowing it. And so everything got pulled for a very short period of time, but quite costly. And they got to control the pricing. And that was a really pivotal moment for us because it suddenly meant, okay, we can make these kind of books appear that are going to work on your Kindle or whichever device you kind of want to consume them on. And you don't have to have a physical book anymore. Or if there's incentive for the author to be able to do it because the price is there, the value exchange is there. So yeah, it was exciting. I really enjoyed it. I think working in really premium content was that kind of platform for me to be able to go back into digital, as I was saying at AOL, to kind of do it from a journalistic perspective, because I kind of understood the mindset. People who are spending their careers writing great content, they want to, it should be respected and it should also be discovered. And so trying to find those different paths to make that happen requires sometimes a little bit of commercialization. And that was what I was able to do. But equally, I did miss the kind of progression of technology. They've come a long way now. And my old boss who ran digital is now their CEO globally. But, you know, I think that's exactly the kind of, I guess, the line of progression that they were going to go down. And it was exciting to be part of it in those very early days.
Fantastic stuff. All right, we have a lot to talk about Zephyr, so I think we need to start to move the clock forward. But you also had a pretty good cup of coffee at another company that we love, OpenX. And I'd love to talk a little bit about that. They're a terrific outfit. John's still a good buddy, and we really love that place.
Yeah, it was fortuitous. The kind of opportunity came along. I was at a mobile location business just before that called Bliss. And I'd kind of, with AOL, the challenge was that there at that time, mobile was not their strength, and I wanted to move into that. And again, when OpenX came to me, it's like, I really want to be an ad tech. I really want to be on the pulse of programmatic. And genuinely, when I went there, I thought I knew programmatic. And as I always tell people, when you go onto the supply side, nothing until you get there. And actually, what happens on the other side of the equation, you're all about demand and demand generation, or had been traditionally. And then you go there and you actually understand what connects the dots. And I think header bidding, all these things I'd never really had to think about. I just had SSPs as a logo. Look, we can get everything we need, you know, and suddenly you really understand how important the role was that they were playing within that space. And also it was during that time of supply path optimization, maybe kind of 2.0, you know, rather than where it is now. But I think that was a really interesting time being at an omni-channel, big SSP like OpenX, where they have been the kind of architects of header bidding and democratized content, and made it very accessible for everyone to bid at the same time. And that was a really big thing at the time. And it worked very well for the publishers. And that was kind of their mindset, was that it's always going to be publisher first. And then SPO happened, and you start to think, well, actually, maybe we also need to start connecting the dots to the demand side. You know, what do the brands actually think? What do the agencies think? And if they're narrowing down how many DSPs they're connecting to, and we could see it because you can see the flow of where your demand is coming from. The likes of the Trade Desk were really emerging and suddenly really challenging DV360. And it was all very kind of compelling that fewer tech partners is better because you can have more controls, certainly from an agency and brand perspective. But we had to have our finger on the pulse and make sure that suddenly we were having those conversations. I was brought in to sort of balance the publisher business and be able to explain why it's important to a media buyer at MediaCom, for example. But ultimately, it was to really open up the dialogue between brands and agencies who are trying to find the best supply source, trying to find the strongest economics. So what makes sense? How can you have everything that's fully transparent and log level data being shared? How can you make it useful? But ultimately, once you know what the price point is, which is obviously the crux of the conversation, how do you start to balance pushing down take rates, but to generate more incremental growth of that business? And that can only really happen if you start to have fewer partners, rather than, we would talk to some agencies, they're like, oh, I think we're connected to like 85 different exchanges. And that just doesn't make any sense, because it might be $50, $300, $500,000. There was no rhyme or reason to what was happening. And there was no analysis going like, what's good supply? What do we need to make it better? You know, what are the things that will make our lives easier and more efficient when we're buying? These programmatic buyers were incredibly busy at agencies working across so many different vendors. And actually, it was sort of that step away from that legacy ad network behavior, really, where it was, who did you have a nice lunch with, to actually, we really want to make sure that our choices are based on tech efficacy rather than just a hunch that we think they're nice people and, you know, this is probably an okay business and we don't think there's anything bad happening. So it was really great experience to kind of be part of that. And I got to know some really incredible brands and to really diversify who my relationships were with the agencies, honestly. And I think being part of a business that has such kind of could reach so far reaching in different markets with different devices, with different types of formats, you know, and then trying to build out a new identity at that time so that there was a point of difference, because that was the main challenge. When you narrowed it down to maybe the top six exchanges, how do you have a differentiation between them? And I would say there were some things that OpenX did really well and some things that, you know, the others did really well at too.
Really interesting stuff. And your tech chops, obviously, you know, advancing to the Beethoven level, you know, working in a company like that?
Honestly, completely new language. It was the first few weeks, I was like, I'm not sure if I'm ever going to understand this. And then I realized that the trick was to make it simple, because actually you can overcomplicate the hows with kind of technology. And actually, if my mum can understand what I'm doing, which is very rare, then you kind of know that you've actually got a really strong grasp of it. And actually anyone that you're talking to can kind of go, okay, I get this. I understand why it's important. I understand why you're coming to me. Certainly what I was doing at OpenX was, I want to speak to you about this. And they're like, you're an exchange. Why would I speak to you? And that really took time to be able to kind of get that transition of mindset to go, actually, it is important that I speak with you. And this is what I want to now do next. And before, it was always very dependent on what the DSPs were saying.
Fantastic stuff. So let's talk about your journey to Zephyr. You've been there a couple of years now. Talk about the journey. How'd you get there?
Well, I mean, there's no kind of linear path to my career in terms of, you know, I haven't made obvious choices. What I've always tried to do is challenge myself to do something different, because I could always go to a competitor and do something similar, but actually I'd like to have different problems or different conversations when I try something new. So Rich Radden came to me and we started having a conversation about what they were doing. It took me, I was like, well, I don't get it. Okay. So you look after YouTube. Okay. So brand safety. Oh, that's interesting. You know, as a mother, you know, you start to think, when I'm showing my child a Cocomelon clip and then there's an ad there, firstly, it's kind of annoying, but ultimately, I don't know that I feel comfortable with that experience. And then what is the ad? Oh, it's targeted at me, but it's my two-year-old watching it. I kind of started to understand that there's maybe an opportunity that we can work with those platforms, we can work with brands, with agencies, and try to be a little bit more responsible and try and think and predict about how things are changing, where consumers are going to get a diverse range of content. And traditionally, if you thought about YouTube, it was music videos. It's not now. And we also work with TikTok and Meta, but these social content can be created by anybody. And it's what's motivating them to post content, share content. And ultimately for brands, and this is, you know, the problem that we try to help them navigate, is what are they funding? You know, you can have preference around where you want to target and your content adjacencies. And the platforms really do a very good job today of managing the very, like what we would call a floor violation, which is extreme content that, you know, shouldn't really exist. But sometimes a content creator will mislabel it, or actually I'll get a few more users if I don't say this is kids, and suddenly something can slip through the net. And because moment to moment content trends and what's being consumed can change a lot, so you know, it could be something really significant like Hamas and Israel, or there's a new election coming, or it can be Taylor Swift is doing something and everybody cares about it right now. So it can be very difficult to keep up with the speed of change and what the meaning behind that kind of content adjacency might be for a brand. I talked about it earlier. Brands have spent, some of them, hundreds of years cultivating what they stand for and having some sort of relationship with their consumer. And so it is important that when you're appearing in these platforms where there's enormous scale and enormous opportunity to have some sort of relationship or dialogue with a customer, that you are getting what you intended to get in terms of where your ad is showing, but also that you have the level of transparency. You know, walled gardens are called walled gardens for a reason. And I think they've allowed us to come in and work with them and integrate into their inventory filters so that we can help to give another perspective on it. And what I will say about all three of the platforms that we work with, we specialize in walled gardens, that they really are supportive of aligning with us. And we have very good feedback loops between what content we measure and then how we score it in line with GARM. And ultimately, how we then help buyers and brands manage their kind of profiles moving forward.
And we referenced it earlier, but particularly timely, certainly here in the States in 2024, it's an election year. talk about that misinformation and where Zephyr sits in that whole really real, just a tremendous hornet's nest for us here in America. Certainly, without question, our democracy is very much under siege.
Absolutely. So it's not just in the US. 4 billion people are eligible to vote this year around the world. There are going to be, the reason it's called the Year of Elections is because it's happening all over the world. I think that is an interesting challenge in itself, because we will hear a lot about UK politics, US politics, but in these smaller markets, I think they are experiencing some of the same challenges we are, populist politics. How are people making their decisions? How is democracy actually being applied? These big social platforms have become, certainly for young audience, but I would say it's pretty much everyone, are going to environments like TikTok or like Instagram, and they are being either intentionally exposed to content around politics and elections, or certainly they're finding their way to it. And the challenge is, especially in social, it's not a journalist. It's not someone who is an expert in politics. It's just someone who has an opinion. And we saw this with Israel and Gaza, that the rise in content was incredibly significant. And it could be someone who normally is a beauty content creator telling you how to contour your face, and suddenly they have an opinion on Palestine. I think that's okay, but for brands, most of them want to kind of go down the middle and not actually show whether they lean left or right. Not exclusively, there are some who do, but ultimately they don't want to suddenly find themselves adjacent to really sensitive content. And if you could have been looking at a video around visiting Israel, and suddenly you're consuming a video around a music festival, and it's really not what it was meant to be. I think it's incredibly important that firstly, we're able to moderate and understand what's happening. And the way we do that at Zephyr is that we've always had machine learning. So everyone talks about AI. We've always had AI at the heart of our business. But AI is important because it helps you do things at high scale and make accurate predictions. But ultimately, something's got to train it. And we use human moderation to train our AI alongside the metadata around the video itself. And that human moderation allows us to be a little bit more nimble. So we can retrain the AI as things happen, so it becomes faster to actually figure out this isn't going to be appropriate, and so we should be flagging it. And ultimately, it helps us to really understand more accurately what a piece of content is about, and not just how it's been labeled or the text that's surrounding it can be quite misleading, as I referenced before. So we have built a very unique approach to analyzing UGC content, and that's why we've specialized in it, because we think it's a big problem. And to your point, with a lot of external events that have been happening, and also with the Global Alliance for Responsible Media, or GARM, bringing out their 12th category, which was misinformation. We wanted to be on the pulse and figure out how to do that. And we realized that our traditional human moderation approaches weren't actually going to be enough, because it's pretty subtle, some of this stuff, and we're not all experts at it. And so we acquired a business called AdVerify 18 months ago, and they have a very similar model of AI and humans, but they use global fact-checking organizations who are specifically focused on identifying misinformation. And that really is important when you're talking about different languages and different countries, because if you were translating something in you know, an African market, for example, it might have a very different interpretation. And so we have built the most robust technology and approach to understanding misinformation across these environments, because we can do it at high scale, because we're predicting and learning and scoring content based off that training data. And ultimately, we're trying to then sort of predict, well, what happens now? You know, generative AI was the big thing of 2023. Everyone was talking about it. And some of it's really cool. You know, ChatGPT is great, DALL-E is great. But it does mean that there's been another democratization of who can create content and how quickly and how easily. You know, at the click of a button, you can now generate a speech, or you can, you know, create a picture or even a video. Initially, they weren't that convincing. You could see maybe it was a six-legged cat instead of a four-legged, and it was obvious to pick out, but technology is getting better and better. And so the rise of deep fakes has been a significant problem, especially as we start to align it with politics and elections. There have been many instances of US politicians being caught up in videos saying that they've said something that they didn't say, or we had it over here with our Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, pulling a really bad pint of Guinness. And, you know, some of this feels fairly inane and like it's not that significant, but actually, when people are going to be voting, they need to be able to identify with the politics, the person. They need to be informed and have legitimate content that is helping to inform their decision. We want to encourage people to vote. And these platforms are all about freedom of speech, so anyone can do that. And I think that's important too. But ultimately, a brand shouldn't be caught up and funding content that isn't legitimate. And so being able to identify that is the first stage of the problem. We're helping them do that. What we saw in the Middle East, for example, was that brands were starting to also be caught up in it. So people were taking brands' logos and images, and we call it brand misappropriation, creating images or saying the brand supports terrorism or funds Hamas. That is not something that we think is good. And so we're building tools right now to try and address that problem so that we can report not just on misinformation in line with GARM's definition, but go really a bit deeper and start to look at what kind of misinformation is it. And the elections is the first stage of this. We are training our tech to understand the faces of different politicians all around the world so that we can actually start to predict this is a deep fake of Trump, for example.
Such a complex subject, and used a couple words that really stand out. One is democratization, but democratization also means the same tools fall into the hands of bad actors as well as good actors. And I love that you referenced the humans and humanity, which I think really in so many ways exemplifies your career journey, that it's tech driven, but there's a humanity behind it, and that behind all these AI tools, and Zephyr certainly leading the way forward in terms of navigating this very delicate space around brand safety and suitability and GARM and beyond, that it is humans behind that technology. That's really interesting. What a joyful conversation this was. I really enjoyed it, Emma. Thank you. I can't thank you enough for doing it.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been really fun.
All right. We will absolutely stay in touch.
Look forward to it. I'll see you soon. Thank you very much.
Cheers.